Hey, this is Karen, Coach's Corner Chats, and joining me is Aaron Henderson. Aaron, where are you at and what are you up to?
I am in Chattanooga, Tennessee. If you don't know where that is, it's about 2 hours to Nashville, 2 hours to Atlanta. So a nice little location in Eastern Tennessee. And much like other sports families, I'm finished up my day job for the day and have moved on to dropping the kids off for sports and, you know, the evening mayhem.
I hear a little bit of a twang. Is Tennessee like born and bred, or has that come from just being around it?
Absolutely not. You are probably the first person to ever say they heard a twang in this area. I grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and but I've been in Tennessee for the last 13 years, and most people would probably say that my accent has softened quite a bit in the 13 years that I've been down here.
You mentioned your kids being involved in sports. If we go back to the beginning, what was Aaron's experience as a youth with sports?
I grew up in a soccer family. Both of my parents were longtime coaches. Probably both of them coached over 35 years, if I had to guess. I'm the youngest of five, so I was always on a soccer field. And my parents had us very active in sports from the time we were little. You know, they said it was the only way they could keep track of where all five of us were and make sure they knew who we were with and what we were up to. They always knew all of our friends and all of the parents of the friends. And my parents both coached both myself and my older brother multiple times. So just grew up in a soccer family. I played up until college, and one of my older brothers also played in college. Soccer family, probably a pretty classic story for, you know, people who then get their kids into sports.
When you look back, what was that experience of having mom and dad as a coach and as mom and dad?
You know, it was pretty interesting. I think it put a lot of pressure on, you know, me at different times. My mom coached me for several years. She was very well known for being a really phenomenal coach. I think, you know, she was very concerned about favoritism or appearing to ever, you know, treat me like I was special or different. And so I think it was, you know, a learning experience for both of us, you know, how to kind of navigate that. But I really loved it and enjoyed it. And, you know, my parents got to be at all of my games, and it was different then too. You know, there weren't really as many paid coaches. There was not the pressure put on kids like there is now, and this thought that every 7-year-old is going to be a Division I soccer player. So I think it was a different time growing up, and it was a little bit more normal for that to be the case. But I really enjoyed it. I got to talk, you know, strategy and really absorb all of the aspects of the game, you know, because my parents were both coaches.
So as you continue that sporting experience up through high school, what happens after high school? Where does Aaron go after high school?
I had a really phenomenal high school experience. And that opened up a lot of doors. I was in the newspaper pretty often. I scored a lot of goals. I'm pretty sure I still hold a school record and I have a banner in my high school for scoring over 100 goals. So it really put my name out there, and I got heavily recruited. And I did get a full ride to college to play soccer. So I chose a Division II school and played there for a couple of years. And then I had to transfer because of my major. And when I transferred, I actually moved into coaching instead of playing at that point. So it was, you know, all the way through college, I was active in soccer, but just in different ways.
When you mentioned scoring 100 goals, we see this a lot on this kind of that battle on Twitter of people always chasing the D1 kind of dream. What was it that drew you to the D2 level?
Yes. I met with a lot of Division I schools. And I just felt like the school I chose was a better fit for me. You know, that smaller school, I felt like I wanted to know my teachers. I wanted them to know me. And I was also going to be a science major. And so I felt like the time commitment, it would have been a lot of travel going to a Division I school. And so I opted to go to a Division II school, which I now know is not actually that much less of a time commitment. You know, the NCAA publishes data about how many hours their student athletes spend. And Division II athletes don't actually spend much less time than Division I athletes on their travel and athletic commitments. So it's probably, I really probably should have gone to a Division III school. I probably would have had a much better experience, I think. But just being a science major, I was really concerned about the being able to navigate the academics.
How helpful was having like older siblings that had gone through, you talk about a brother that played at the college level and such, how helpful was it having them and even having parents that were coaching and kind of in the mix to helping you during that recruiting time?
Recruitment was so different than it is now. You know, there was no social media, probably age myself, but there was like MySpace and Facebook and, it wasn't near the process that it is now. I mean, I'm going through it now as a parent mm-hmm. with my daughters, and it's just totally different game. I think my parents were very well suited to help me navigate the soccer piece, you know, to go through that process, that part of the process. But I was the first one in my family to pursue a career in the sciences. And I don't think we as a family or, you know, I don't think my parents could really advise me on that piece because it was so different than what my brothers and sisters had done out of college.
Was science something you were always drawn to, even at, like in when you were a youngster? Was science fairs kind of that thing? Was that just a kind of a something you just latched onto?
Oh, Kieran, you're gonna make me sound like such a nerd. I can vividly remember the moment I decided I was going into the sciences. It was like my sophomore year of high school, and we did this flame test in chemistry class where you like put different ions in a flame and they turn different colors. And I was sold right then. It was like, okay, I'm going to go do something in the sciences. This is pretty cool. So yeah, that's pretty nerdy, I would say. But it was my sophomore year of high school where I decided that was what I was going to pursue.
Have you been one of those that once you kind of pick, like, this is one I want to go after, you're like 100% like locked in and like, that's it, or hyper-focused?
I am super goal oriented, but I actually have very like diverse set of interests. I often tell people this story about when I came home. I was probably a sophomore in college, and I told my parents that I was taking a sociology class and that I was going to change my major from chemistry and biochemistry to sociology. And my dad did not even look up from the book he was reading. And he said, "Aaron, I'm just going to ask you one question." I said, "Okay." And he said, "Do you like to eat?" And I said, I do. And he said, "Keep doing what you're doing, kid." So I stuck with the sciences at that point. But I've always had like very diverse interests. I mean, there was a period of time where I was planning to go be a doctor or a pharmacist. And then I graduated from college and got an MBA. And I started to work in the sciences. I worked at DuPont as a research scientist. And it was interesting what I really enjoyed in college. I didn't enjoy as a day job. And so then I kind of pivoted and switched careers, and became a leader very, very early in my professional career, which is why I'm so passionate about the topic of leadership. And when I did that, became a leader, you know, kind of so early in my career, I used to joke with people that I have a degree in biochemistry and a degree in business and all this leadership experience, but the most useful degree for me would have been psychology, because leading people is all about understanding people. And that was ultimately why 4.5, almost 5 years ago now, I started my PhD in psychology.
You talked about being at the D2 school and then moving for academics and then kind of getting into coaching a little bit. How difficult was that to kind of put some closure on your playing days and then just kind of focus on the academics and coaching?
I think it was very easy for me then. When I picked the school I went to, I didn't pick what would have been, should have been a good fit for me. Some of my teammates were heavy partiers and they were people I lived with. And I was not, and, I should have thought through that. You know, that's why I'm big. If you see some of my posts about culture and questions you can ask to help figure out culture, because of my own experience, with that, by the time I made the decision that I had to transfer schools, for academic reasons, I was kind of done. You know, I felt like, okay, this is not going to be a profession for me. You know, there weren't a lot of professional female soccer players at that point. It wasn't really a viable career path. And so when I had to move for, due to my major, because there was nobody else had my same major at that school, and got to the point where they were not going to offer me classes in my major, it kind of made it easy for me. I started to coach high school at the high school I went to. The coach that I had played for was still there, and I really, really respected him. He invested a lot in me, and I was very happy to coach JV for a couple of years before I started really my professional career and had to put coaching to the side for a while.
What's that dynamic like to come back? I mean, you talk about a banner on the wall. You're known for being this like really talented scoring machine. What's it like to then come back and be on the other side of the sidelines, I guess, in a way?
Even though I grew up with soccer coaches as parents and had this great role model in my high school coach, I don't think I knew what I was doing at the time. You know, I didn't, I kind of just did practices that, you know, that we had done when I was in high school. And I wish I would have thought more about the people I was coaching and less just kind of about the mechanics of coaching, if that makes sense. I think some of the people that I coached or was around, they just thought it was cool. you know, here she is, like, you know, we've heard of her and we've seen her around, and we, every time we walk in our gym, there's a banner with her name on it, and it's the only one on that banner. And so they, I think they thought it was cool. I enjoyed it for a couple of years. It was, I mean, the pay was not good. It was not a good hourly rate. I probably needed to do something a little bit more lucrative at that point, but it was a fun experience, and I'm glad I did it looking back.
You mentioned now being just in love with the idea of leadership and how to create quality leadership. Was there a moment, even you're talking about being a DuPont and kind of working through some things, was there a moment that kind of pushed you in that direction, or how did that opportunity come about that leadership and psychology and that type of stuff is what you're focused on now?
So I went to work at a nuclear plant. And after I left DuPont, it's probably not something you hear very often, Kieran, somebody going to work at a nuclear plant. I went to work at a nuclear plant. And when I was working there, I had just started there, and I was young. I mean, only a year and a half or so out of college. They had a failed merger. And when that happened, all of the leaders that were in place had to kind of say, were they staying or going? And it really was a very interesting time in an organization to see the turmoil that can cause, but also the opportunities that it can create for people like me. And so I became a leader in a nuclear plant very early in my career. And I've just been passionate about it ever since. I would think, though, you know, if I think about my first leadership experiences, it's really before then. I mean, I was captain of every team I was ever on, and, you know, president of clubs in high school, and, you know, had different supervisory roles at jobs that I worked at throughout college. So, when I talk to people that I went to high school with or something like that, you know, they'll kind of say stuff like, oh, we always knew you were going to do something. But I don't think I viewed myself that way until, you know, much later into my career.
One of the things I always wonder about is how has kind of getting to understand leadership better and help others become better at leaders, how has that impacted you in terms of, you talk about your daughters right now and you're helping with like recruiting and they're growing up. How has it impacted you as a parent in terms of how you deal with your children?
It really has immensely changed me. I talk to my kids about it very often. I talk to them about leadership and how to treat people, how to treat your teammates. You know, even just my own experience from listening to women tell me their stories from when they were college athletes, you know, the importance of being inclusive and being positive and helping others, it really has left such an incredible impression on me that I talk to my daughters about it pretty regularly. They would probably tell you I talk to them about it too much, but I'm especially thinking about that a lot now that they're teenagers and only have a couple years left in my house. You know, what kinds of lessons do I need to make sure I'm imparting on them? And, you know, I watch them interact with their teammates. I watch them interact with their coaches, and often give them feedback on my thoughts about it. But also, you know, we spend a lot of time just in the car talking about how did practice go. And, you know, they might tell me a situation that happens and we'll have a discussion about, well, why do you think that person might be acting that way? What do you think is really going on? And, you know, maybe they need somebody to be more supportive of them or things like that. So, I'm trying in, you know, small doses to kind of help them build their own, you know, leadership style, whatever that is and whatever that looks like. And just trying to teach them how to be a good teammate and just a good person, you know, in general.
I love the comment about their own kind of leadership style. I think sometimes we do a lot of, like, we point at one coach that's been successful and we're like, oh, that's the leadership style that I should try to emulate. How important is it to kind of almost like a self-reflection, like knowing yourself better so you can be a better leader?
Yeah, I had a moment in 2015 where I spent most of my career as the only woman leader in a room. And so I would say I spent a good portion of my career trying to lead like my male counterparts. And I don't think that went so well for me personally. And so in 2015, I started working for somebody, and this seems so silly, but I asked him, hey, would you care if I wear a dress to work? And people don't wear dresses at nuclear plants. And he said, yeah, absolutely. And he said, Aaron, I hired you to be you. And that moment really changed me. It gave me, you know, the confidence to really start to find my own voice as a leader, which sounds so cliche, but it really just means I didn't have a lot of female role models to look up to in my leadership history and, you know, my leadership experience. And so I was kind of having to figure it out and working in this very male dominated, intense Navy nuclear type environment. And there was not a roadmap for me on how to lead. Moreover, because I was, you know, one of the few females in the room, it was a lot of pressure to be successful because, you know, other women might not get the same opportunity to lead at some point if I was not successful. So it was it can be a lot, and it took a long time and a lot of trial and error. So I tell my kids now when we're talking about it, you know, I think sometimes people look at a leader and they say, okay, well, that's who I need to be. Well, if you look at one situation, a leader might be really good in that situation, but they might be terrible in another one. You know, so to just illustrate that, you know, somebody who leads in an organization or a team that is like needs a complete overhaul, well, that's not the same type of leader necessarily that you might want in a situation for a team that's already thriving. And so I've talked to my kids a little bit about it. I mean, obviously they can't understand organizational dynamics and things like that sometimes, but we have discussions about leadership. And sometimes when people say stuff to them, like, oh, this is how you should be. You know, I have one daughter, she's a quiet leader. I would describe her as her leadership style is more quiet. And I always say to her, leadership is not necessarily loud. That's not necessarily leadership. Here's the things you should be doing to grow in your leadership, authentic to who you are. Because if you're phony, people will not want to follow you.
The one thing that I love too about what you said was trial and error. How important it has been for you, and then just like finding yourself in terms of like the leadership and helping others, that ability to face failure. You talked about that kind of stress and pressure to be successful. Like I'm in a spot that not every woman's had the opportunity to be at, and I've got to crush it. But how big was it to actually have those not so great moments and then to actually be able to learn and improve from those?
I have failed pretty epically in my career at different points in time. And honestly, some of those failures have, you know, there's the little failures, you know, the things that are kind of little and easily recoverable. And, you know, you just learn from it and it's like, okay, that probably wasn't a good approach to take. And I'm going to learn from this and move on. Then there's, you know, those kind of really epic career failures, you know, those really, really big growing experiences. And I've had one of those. And that kind of hits you a little bit differently because it goes right to your ego, right? It goes right to who do you think you are at your core? And that very interestingly caused me to really evaluate very deeply, where do I get my confidence from? You know, where does my self-confidence come from? And I would say for many years, even though I was a mom and had a family and was investing in real estate and had all these other things going on, I got my self-confidence from doing well at work. And when, you know, when I went through a situation where it appeared as though I wasn't, I had to reevaluate who I was and what motivates me and where I get my confidence from. And I think you have to go through a pretty big failure to really look inward and say, who really am I? And what do I really care about as a person? And I've definitely had one of those experiences. It kind of shook me to my core, but I've always tell people I came out the other side of it just a better human and a much more empathetic leader. So that, you know, when people that worked for me were dealing with situations, I was much more compassionate, much more understanding than I was previously.
When you look back and you made that decision, like, I'm going back to school, I want to get this, get into psychology and get into that mix. What was that experience like of diving back into school and like the investment and the, you know, the motivation and all that type of stuff? What was that experience like going back into school and doing all that?
I had kind of always known that at some point I wanted to get a doctorate degree. It was just something that was important to me. And, you know, my parents, we grew up in a family that my parents did the very best they could, but it's hard to raise five kids. And, you know, we didn't have much of everything growing up. And so my parents always said to us, you know, hard work and education, that's going to be what helps you rise out of this. And I really took that to heart. And so I knew at some point I wanted to get my PhD, that I wanted to have, you know, kind of the highest level of degree that you could get. And I just didn't know what I wanted to get it in. And then I took over a role where I was responsible for organizational effectiveness at a site. And I thought, oh, this is something I could go pursue. So I actually started off like down the path of industrial and organizational psychology. And I was planning to get my PhD in research burnout in female leaders in STEM. And I spent a couple of years working down that path. It was not easy. It was, most of the classes were pretty, that part of the process was, you know, like riding a bike. You know, if you've ever gone to school, you're kind of used to the process of, I write papers, I submit them, I get grades, right? And so that part of the process wasn't too bad. But the time commitment. I had to be very honest with myself about how fast I wanted to get that done, what I was willing to sacrifice to do it. And I really had to look inward a few times and say, like, do you really want to do this? You know, is this really worth the effort? You have a well-paying job and, you know, a good home life. And what are you trying to get out of this? I see people sometimes when they decide to pursue their PhD and they say, I'm getting done in this amount of time and it's rigid and I'm going to, you know, not have a life. I'm going to sacrifice all of my family time. I'm going to, you know, basically table the rest of my life for the entire period of time that it takes to do this. And, you know, to be damned with the consequences of that. And I decided very thoughtfully that that wasn't going to be the approach that I took. That's very hard though for a goal-oriented person to be like, you know what, if this takes me a year longer than I had planned, okay. But I had to like keep myself in check several times because I didn't want to miss anything for my kids. But it did mean that I spent car rides working on papers. And, you know, when my kids were warming up, I would be, you know, on the sideline sometime reading or writing while I was sitting there. And when I ultimately kind of got to the end, I was interviewing participants in my study from our vacation in Italy just to get done. So it was an interesting process to kind of figure out if I really wanted to do that. And then it also, you know, during many different points of time, it tested how serious I was to completing it.
What is the process once you complete that? You get your PhD and you're like, what's next? Like, how do you get to the point where you're at now where you're impacting others and you're actually, like you just talked about, you finished your day job before getting the girls to practice and all that kind of stuff. Like, what does Aaron do to say, okay, I've got my PhD. I know, I feel like I can make an impact on others. How do you get the ball rolling and get something, I guess, almost formulated or organized to the point where you're at now?
I'm still working on that. to be honest, I do not have it figured out. I really finished, I defended my dissertation in, I think it was like June of last year. I had no idea what I was going to do next because I had spent, you know, at least the previous year, really just trying to get done. It is not a process for people who are not very patient. Like me, I am not patient. That is not my strength. That is not my strong suit. And so I just spent so much time just trying to get to the end that I kind of just thoughtfully said, I will think about what I do with this after I'm done. And then I finished, and then I spent 2 months just decompressing, I would say, you know, kind of, what the heck do I do now? You know, what do I do with this? Aside from having some useful knowledge and being able to better advise my kids and better advise some of their friends and talk to people about it. You know, it's still to some extent a cool thing I did, but I'm still figuring out, you know, how do I really make the most impact on people with this knowledge that I have that I'm not trying to keep to myself, but I'm trying to figure out what are the most effective ways to impact people. And I really only started using Twitter in maybe July. I had it before then, but I was not active on it. I probably had never posted anything until July. And honestly, I think I only had a couple hundred followers until that post about, you know, burnout All of a sudden it exploded. And before I know it, you know, I was up to where I am now. And so I'm still thinking about where do I go from here? I just switched companies and started kind of a new day job. So I'm heavily focused on that at the moment, but I'm continuing to think about how do I want to show up as a performance psychologist, and how do I help people? Because really that's what I want to do with it.
You talked about just the ability to get to where you're at now and just the experiences you've had, some good, some bad. What has it been like for your parents to watch you kind of develop and get to the point where you're now talking about, I want to make an impact on others. I want to do, you know, really good things leadership wise. Well, how fun has it been for that? And even for your family, like your daughters, like in the house, what has it been like for them to kind of watch their mom, you know, take some kind of leaps of faith to, and even right now, still kind of not know where we're headed next, but knowing that I want to do something that I'm passionate about and I love.
My parents are very, very proud of all five of us. I think, and they've just been very supportive of everything I've pursued. It was very meaningful. My parents were at my graduation, and I'm so grateful I got to have that experience with them, because you just never know when they won't be there. And so I was really grateful. They live in a retirement community in Arizona now, and I am sure they have talked much about, you know, about my accomplishments and about the accomplishments really of all my brothers and sisters. My parents are very proud of us. And I owe a lot to them. They really, it was not easy for them for most of my childhood. And I'm very grateful to my parents for just the impact they had on me. My kids, that's a funny question. So I often joke with my kids and I'll say, are you ever proud of me? Like, do you realize, you know, some of the things I've accomplished while being your mother and you know, continuing to take you to all over the country for your sporting events? And so I don't know that they can like fully appreciate it. My daughter likes to humble me. And she, for a long time, when we would talk about the fact that I was going to have a PhD and people would call me doctor, my daughter would tell me, you're not a real doctor. And I'm like, okay, fair enough. If somebody needs CPR, I am not the person you want to do it. But on any academic campus in the world, really, I would be called doctor. And it wasn't until some of her her friends' parents like said, no, she's like legit. So I think, you know, teenagers, they don't really fully grasp it, but I do feel confident that they're watching me and learning from me, and hopefully I'm having a positive impact on them, that if they decide to have a family or not, or decide to go down different paths for their career, that they've had a positive, you know, role model of how to navigate work and life and family and, you know, all of those things along the way.
You mentioned earlier, you dropped the word culture. You talked about watching your daughters interact with their peers, with their coaches. There's a lot of information out there coming out now about mental health and dealing, you know, the sports psychology side of things and what have you. What are some things, coaches, there's so much out there. What are some things, like, if you had to pick your hot topic type things? What are some things that we as coaches could like latch onto and start right now and see like large benefits?
I think the number one thing that really stuck out for me, I'll offer a couple of things, but the first thing is, especially for female athletes, the number one thing that they want is to feel included. And a Twitter follower actually recommended very recently a book about the teenage brain, and it really talks about, you know, when people are teenagers, that they're shifting to this view of like they care much more about what their peers think and how to be included. And but the desire to be included and to feel included is the primary reason that most of these kids do or do not want to play, or do or do not feel you know, maybe experience burnout. And so I would say, as coaches, even as parents, you know, encouraging the players to be very inclusive. I was recently joking with a parent. I said, like, don't be that parent who has a birthday party for the kids and teaches the kid it's okay not to invite two of his teammates. Like, that's not cool. And that's not helpful to the team environment. And it will really undercut a team's performance and a team's chemistry. And so I would say, you know, any type of practices or any type of, yeah, practices, not in the skill sense, but any sort of practices where a coach can focus on inclusion is really, really important, especially on female teams.
You talked earlier about finishing up your PhD in Italy. What does Aaron do to kind of get away? You talk about the grind of trying to make sure that I don't get too caught up in my PhD because I've got family. How do you keep balance, and what things do you do to kind of maybe just get away?
Well, I continue to work out just like I'm an athlete. So that has been one thing that I've just found as I've gotten older, the purpose has changed of, you know, why I exercise. But I didn't quite realize what a stress reliever that was with, you know, having a background as an athlete until I had a job and a commute where there was this period of time that I couldn't work out or couldn't work out routinely. And the buildup of stress in my body had just like really, really significant consequences. So I've never done that again. I've never had a period of time where I have not routinely exercised. So that has been, you know, kind of my mental, physical escape has always been moving my body in some way, shape, or form. Other than that, you know, as a family, we're big on traveling, and we have a family rule where we have to go somewhere new every year. And we've really done some cool trips. And for me, it's not just about getting away, but it's about exposing my kids to something different. And sometimes something uncomfortable, right? They're getting to appreciate what it feels like to be in a foreign country where you don't understand the language and can't read a menu, you know, things like that, so that they kind of build a much broader worldview than, you know, I grew up in Eastern Tennessee and that's all I know, and I eat barbecue. I mean, I'm joking to some extent, but I want them to experience the world, and it makes me happy to see them get to experience that. And I love to travel too. So we've done some pretty cool trips, like as a family. I mean, we went to the World Cup in France a few years ago. And this past year, we went to Italy and Turks and Caicos. And so I always like to plan some type of epic adventures for us.
One of the things that's kind of been almost a theme is just almost the idea of empowering females. Like you went through, you talked about being in a male dominated kind of environment business wise and what have you. And now you're pouring into your daughters and like helping other parents and all that stuff. How important has the fact that now you're a female doctorate, you're getting, you know, a growing following on Twitter, you're starting, your voice is getting out there, you're looking to continue to grow and kind of go more in that direction. How important is it for you as a female to continue to keep kind of just building and helping not only yourself, but those that you can connect with, females and such?
Yeah, I feel like it's, you know, as you advance in your career and as you just get older in general, you start to think about what's the mark you're going to leave, you know, on the world. You know, how do I leave it somehow better because I existed, you know? And so for me, it is, I really love when I get DMs or questions from young women and can help them either navigate something professionally or, you know, navigate some piece of their athletic journey or leadership journey. And I really love it. So, and I'm doing it for free. Like, you know, right now this is not how I'm making money. And so, it's really important to me that I feel like I've given back in some way. And so I enjoy that. And it's definitely something that is very, very important to me.
That is a perfect way to end this chat. This is Karen with Aaron Henderson, and I'm out. Peace. Hey, this is Karen, Coach's Corner Chats, and I absolutely love chatting with coaches about their coaching journey. What's even better is I love that you took the time to listen to this episode and hope you enjoyed it. What I'd like to ask is take the time to join me on social media, especially on Twitter and Instagram, at Coaches Let's Chat. That's where we can connect and continue to build this community. Be a part of this awesome, awesome experience that I know you'll enjoy. Let's go. Peace.